This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Power is a lot like real estate. It's all about location, location, location. The closer you are to the source, the higher your property value.
That's Kevin Spacey, who stars as an ambitious congressman in the new political thriller series House of Cards, an original production of and available only on Netflix. Before we talk with Kevin Spacey and David Fincher, the show's executive producer and director of the first two episodes, let's hear a review of House of Cards from our TV critic David Bianculli. He says that the show is not only excellent, but may prove to be historic.
The last time Kevin Spacey had a recurring role in a TV series was a full 25 years ago, when he played the creepy magnetic villain Mel Prophet in the landmark CBS series Wise Guy. Now Spacey returns to television as the star of House of Cards, a remake of a wonderful British miniseries from 1990. That series, which eventually expanded to a trilogy, starred Ian Richardson as a career politician who spoke to the camera directly as he schemed and charmed his way through the corridors of power. It was based on the novels by Michael Dobbs and was adapted by Andrew Davies, who wrote Bridget Jones's Diary and the TV versions of Bleak House, Pride and Prejudice, and Vanity Fair. This new American version has both Spacey and David Fincher, who directed Spacey in the haunting crime movie Seven, as executive producers. Fincher also directs the opening episodes of this new House of Cards, which is adapted by playwright Bo Willimon. To Americanize this political drama, he replaces the House of Commons with the White House, an incoming prime minister with an incoming president, and lots of other details that help make this new House of Cards the best TV series about American politics since The West Wing. In both the British and American versions of House of Cards, coincidentally, the central character is the Majority Whip, played in this 2013 incarnation by Kevin Spacey, who, as Frank Underwood, is perfectly ruthless and ruthlessly perfect. Robin Wright plays his equally ambitious and cold-blooded wife, Claire, and they're both like characters straight out of Shakespeare. She's Lady Macbeth with her own insatiable drive and ambition. And he's Iago, the evil lieutenant who manipulates everyone below and above him. And Frank, like many a character from Shakespeare, often pauses to address his audience directly and privately to reveal his innermost thoughts. He's giving a soliloquy. But, as in this scene when he pauses during a re-election party to turn to the camera and speak, he turns us viewers into unindicted co-conspirators.
When it comes to the White House, you not only need the keys in your back pocket, you need the gatekeeper. As for me, I'm just the lowly House Majority Whip. I keep things moving in a Congress choked by pettiness and lassitude. My job is to clear the pipes and keep the sludge moving. But I won't have to be a plumber much longer. I've done my time. I've backed the right man. Give and take. Welcome to Washington.
Filmed on location in Baltimore and Washington, D.C., House of Cards looks and feels authentic. And series creator and adapter Bo Willimon knows this world well. Before and after becoming a playwright, he was a campaign worker for Chuck Schumer, Hillary Clinton, Bill Bradley, and Howard Dean. The way Spacey's Underwood manipulates the press, embodied here by Kate Mara as a young newspaper reporter and blogger, is especially smart and credible. But all of House of Cards is intriguing and exciting. The first two episodes I previewed were so good and so addictive, I couldn't wait to see more. And I don't have to. Netflix, which presents House of Cards, has just unveiled not only the pilot, but all 13 episodes of the show's first season. Fans of the series, once they find it on Netflix's streaming service, can dive into some serious binge viewing and watch season one as fast as they want. This isn't the first time, on the internet or on Netflix, that an original production has been presented this way. But House of Cards is by far the best yet. It is to Netflix what The Sopranos was to HBO, what The Shield was to FX, what Mad Men was to AMC. It's an identity maker and a game changer. And unlike all those others, House of Cards arrives all at once. If the broadcast networks especially aren't frightened by this, they should be. Netflix, this week, isn't only making great television, it's making TV history.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. David Fincher's films include Fight Club, Seven, which also stars Kevin Spacey, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, as well as The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and The Social Network, two films that earned him Oscar nominations. Kevin Spacey has two Academy Awards for American Beauty and The Usual Suspects. Among his other films are L.A. Confidential and Glengarry Glen Ross. He's been artistic director of the Old Vic Theatre in London since 2003. We began our conversation with the scene from the first episode of House of Cards, when Spacey's character Frank Underwood finds out that the newly elected president won't be appointing him to Secretary of State, as he'd been expecting. He's just arrived for a meeting with the president-elect's chief of staff, Linda Vasquez, played by Sakina Joffrey.
Okay. This is the memo I've drafted on our Middle East policy we've been developing. Now, I want to borrow from Reagan. I'd like to coin the phrase trickle-down diplomacy.
Frank,
that way,
I'm going to stop you there. We are not nominating you for Secretary of State. I know he made you a promise, but circumstances have changed.
The nature of promises, Linda, is that they remain immune to changing circumstances.
Garrett has thought long and hard about this, and he's decided we need you to stay in Congress.
When was this decision made? And why wasn't I part of a conversation?
I'm sorry, Frank. If it had been up to me, I wouldn't have waited this long to tell you.
So you knew you were going to do this?
It has been an evolving discussion.
It's a chicken move.
Frank.
I was vetted. Was that a ruse?
No.
Let's be absolutely clear. You wouldn't have won without me.
You're right. But now we have to lead. And that means making tough choices. As you know, education is a top priority for us, a complete federal overhaul. But it's not just education, Frank. Congress is split. We need you there more than we need you in the State Department.
I got you hired, Linda.
I know.
Donations, endorsements. I wrote the campaign's entire foreign policy platform. I bring years of Foreign Affairs Committee...
Frank, please.
I want to speak to Walker personally.
The decision is made.
Well, David Fincher, Kevin Spacey, welcome to Fresh Air. It's good to have you both. Do you want to describe your character here, Francis Underwood? He's at the center of this series.
It's very hard to describe a character who I'm still learning about, and it's still evolving, and there's a lot I don't know. I can tell you what he's based on, which is that Michael Dobbs, the writer of the original book, was Margaret Thatcher's press secretary. And after he was sort of unceremoniously thrown out of politics, at least in her government, I think he went off on some holiday and decided as an act of revenge he would write this book, and based the leading character, Francis Urquhart, in that version, on Richard III and a little bit of Iago. So you have a kind of basis there of one of the great... or a couple of the great Shakespearean parts. And then I think what they did with that original series, what Bo Willimon, our head writer, has done on this one is to create a character that is constantly shifting. And for me, this has felt like not only am I in one way, it feels like I'm making a really long movie. In another way, it feels like I'm in a 26-hour championship chess match. Because it's all about the moves and how far ahead Francis sees what the opponent is going to do.
Well, David Fincher, one of the interesting things about this series is that we see direct address where an actor, in this case Kevin Spacey, turns to the camera and speaks to the audience. Are there any kind of guidelines you use about how often to do it or what – in what circumstances you would? I mean, I know Bo Willimon wrote the script, but the risk might be that it breaks the dramatic flow and perhaps sort of makes it a little less believable. Is that something you have to be careful of?
Yeah, it's an ongoing discussion. I mean, we would have, up until the day we would shoot things, we would have conversations about, well, is there enough illumination of what he wants and what he's after in this direct address? Can it support its own weight? Is it essential?
And the thing that I, because I had the experience last year of playing Richard III in the theater, we took a production that Sam Mendes directed to 12 cities around the world for about 10 months. I had the experience of having that very relationship with an audience, because Richard does direct address. It's what it's taken from for House of Cards. So I have this memory of that experience, and I was able to actually look into people's eyes all over the world and see how much they relished it and how dangerous it was and how sporting and naughty they felt in being sort of brought in and made Richard's and now Francis's co-conspirators. The thing that I'm always questioning, and we all are, is this arbitrary? Is this an important thing? And sometimes we've discovered in the course of shooting that actually the dialogue that was written isn't necessary. All you have to do is a look. It's a little bit like the way I've tried to transform my experience in the living theater, which was real people and real eyes, and now I'm, of course, just looking down the barrel of a lens, is to think of it as if I'm talking to my best friend. And in the way that you share things with your best friend that you wouldn't necessarily share with your wife, the asides, I'm trying to play them as if this is the person I trust more than anyone in the entire world.
Well, let's hear a clip. This is early in the first episode when Francis Underwood, our main character, played by Kevin Spacey, has just learned he will not be appointed Secretary of State, as he had expected. And he's spent the day walking around Washington angry and confused. And he comes home at the end of the day, and this is the scene where he sees his wife, Claire, who is played by Robin Wright. Let's listen.
You didn't call. You didn't call me, Francis. 9 hours. You don't not call me. Not when it's this big.
You're right.
When have we ever avoided each other?
I wanted the solution first.
Do you have one?
Not yet.
This affects me too, Francis. And it's not the money I'm upset about. It's that we do things together. When you don't involve me, we're in free fall.
I should have called you, and I didn't.
What happened?
She says they need to keep me in Congress.
Linda said that?
Walker wasn't even there. That's what really gets me. He didn't have the courage to look me in the eye.
I know you shouldn't trust that woman.
I didn't. I don't. I don't trust anyone.
Then how could you not see this coming?
I never thought they were capable.
You don't usually underestimate people, Francis.
I know. Hubris. Ambition.
You should be angry.
I'm livid.
Then where is that? I don't see it.
What do you want me to do? Scream and yell? Throw a tantrum?
I want more than I'm seeing. You're better than this, Francis.
Well, I'm sorry, Claire. I am sorry.
No, that I won't accept.
What?
Apologies. My husband doesn't apologize, even to me.
And that's our guest, Kevin Spacey, with Robin Wright in a scene from House of Cards, the new series on Netflix, which is that episode directed by our other guest, David Fincher. And we should add that the crash we hear at the end of that scene is where Robin Wright is headed upstairs and her husband has thrown a tray or something, finally exhibiting the anger, and then she smiles.
You know, we're looking at people who are just beyond, I think, what we can imagine certain political couples are like, because I mean the kind of stakes that they're playing at, and I love the unfathomable nature of Francis and Claire. I love the idea that, I think we discussed this after seeing the first six or seven scripts. There was a lot of conversation about, you know, whether we were going to dramatize their deal, the deal that they had made with one another. And we just felt like it would be better to, like, just see the behavior, see what came from it.
Kevin Spacey, you've had all this experience at the Old Vic, the theater in London. And I wonder, as you developed the character of Francis Underwood in House of Cards, whether you looked at Francis Urquhart, who was the lead character in the British version of The House of Cards, kind of how you translated that to a different sort of culture and society, how you molded the character differently. Did you draw on that experience?
Well, I watched it about 3 years ago when David first said, hey, look at that. And I remembered the original series, and I had seen the original series. My mother loved that series because it aired on PBS in the United States. But I didn't watch it again after that because you don't want to steal too much from another actor's performance.
Well, they're really kind of pretty different, aren't they? I think, you know.
Well, they are. They're different in many ways, and I think that what Bo Willimon and David and I all were interested in doing was in a sense using the original British series as a launching pad, but that clearly our Francis was going to be different. He's obviously from a different place. He has a different last name, and to a certain degree, how do you negotiate a character that is, in a sense, so beloved in Great Britain and so delicious in terms of the performance, but make it something all of your own. So in a way, by bringing back some of the dialogue, by creating a character who's from the South, which allowed us to, in a sense, in the writing, the sort of rhythmic things that a British accent can do, that maybe an accent in the West or too far East might not work. Those sentences might not come out in quite the sort of fluid musicality that the British accent has. So I think it was a really smart choice to make him from South Carolina.
Kevin Spacey stars in, and David Fincher is the executive producer of the series House of Cards, which is available now only on Netflix. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with actor Kevin Spacey and director David Fincher, who've collaborated on the new political thriller series House of Cards, an original production of Netflix. All 13 episodes of the first season are available now. Kevin Spacey won Oscars for The Usual Suspects and American Beauty. David Fincher got an Oscar nomination for his film The Social Network, based on the Ben Mezrich book about Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. I asked Fincher about the first scene of the film, when Zuckerberg, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is talking in a bar with his girlfriend, played by Rooney Mara. He's a Harvard student anxious to get into one of the prestigious final clubs and is frustrated that she isn't sympathetic.
I'll try to be straightforward with you and tell you that I think you might want to be a little more supportive. If I get in, I will be taking you to the events and the gatherings, and you'll be meeting a lot of people you wouldn't normally get to meet.
You would do that for me?
We're dating.
Okay. Well, I want to try and be straightforward with you and let you know that we're not anymore.
What do you mean?
We're not dating anymore, I'm sorry.
Is this a joke?
No, it's not.
You're breaking up with me?
You are going to introduce me to people I wouldn't normally have the chance to meet. What is that supposed to mean?
Wait, settle down.
What is it supposed to mean?
Erica, the reason we're able to sit here and drink right now is because he used to sleep with the door guy.
The door guy? His name is Bobby. I have not slept with the door guy. The door guy is a friend of mine, and he's a perfectly good class of people. And what part of Long Island are you from? Wimbledon?
Wait.
I'm going back to my door.
Wait, is this real?
Yes.
Okay, then wait. I apologize, okay?
I have to go study.
Erica?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I mean it.
I appreciate that, but I have to go see.
Come on, you don't have to study. You don't have to study. Let's just talk.
I can't.
Why?
Because it is exhausting. Dating you is like dating a stairmaster.
All I meant is that you're not likely to. Currently. I wasn't making a comment on your parents. I was just saying that you go to BU. I was stating a fact. That's all. And if it seemed rude, then of course I apologize.
I have to go study.
You don't have to study.
Why do you keep saying I don't have to study?
Because you go to BU.
And that's Jesse Eisenberg and Rooney Mara in the film The Social Network, directed by our guest David Fincher, and our other guest Kevin Spacey was an executive producer on that project. David Fincher, I know you've been asked about this scene a lot, and it's been written that you did 99 takes with these two actors. And, you know, directors have different approaches. Do you do that a lot because you're working towards a particular performance that you want to get, or is it that you like to have a lot of options when you get to the cutting room? You want to just talk about that a little?
Well, this is something that's been blown out of proportion over the last couple of years. We shot the opening scene. The opening scene in the movie was incredibly important to setting the tone and the pace, and it was a wonderful character introduction for two very important characters. And it's the first of the bookends that make up the arc of this relationship, but the 99 takes is over six setups or something like that. So it's like 15, 20 takes maybe per set, and getting actors to talk over each other in a way that you can actually use in an edit it's difficult. It's tricky because you're committed. You know, you're committed. If they're literally going to interrupt each other, you're committed to that take, that performance of somebody stepping on somebody else's dialogue. So that was that's why we shot as many takes as we did.
First of all, he is right. It's not 99 takes of one camera in one place. It is, you know, there are a lot of directors who will do lots and lots of setups, but very few takes. David doesn't do as many setups, but he does more takes. And part of what I feel when he's doing that, and I like working this way, is that, you know, he's pushing you in a certain direction. He's having you go in a different direction this way. He's having you try a new meaning, a new approach to a line of dialogue in this way. And frankly, the other truth is actors bring a lot of complicated accessories to the set. And some of those accessories are gestures, and some of those accessories are, oh, I found a kind of cute way of saying a line, or I like the way my voice does this, or I'm going to use this Coke can to do this. And I think sometimes what David, it feels like, he's looking for is the cleanest, streamlined version of the idea that the character is trying to express and the way in which that character would express it. And he's just simply, at a certain point, beating the acting out of you. And I'm quite grateful for that. As I look at, you know, particularly the cuts of House of Cards and the episodes that we've done, that there is an absolute clarity. And I think it's true in Social Network as well. There's an extraordinary cleanness to those characters. It's not encumbered by a lot of actorisms, which people often get away with and frankly shouldn't be allowed to get away with. And so I'm very grateful that someone's on the set being the master of his craft.
If my job is ostensibly just to record something, then what you're talking about is, you know, inflicting hardship and pain on on people. But it's not. My job is to coerce a behavioral response that, when it's recontextualized, when a slice of it is taken and put and butted up against another behavioral response, it's supposed to create the sense of, you know, in the case of that opening scene from Social Network, there are a lot of things at play. You want to get the idea that these people know each other, that they've been intimate with one another. They have a, you know, there are all kinds of things that have to be, you have to get glimpses of, and so to get all those little colors and nuances, sometimes you have to, you know, the best actors in the world working things out, you know, at home in their bathtubs, or as they brush their teeth in the mirror. That's perfectly valid. And then there's also the day of, where they come in and the lights are there and 90 people are watching them, and you want to be able to push them around so that they respond in ways that they, you know, maybe didn't give themselves credit for.
And I have to say that I know that I'm better at my job when I'm directed. I'm not better at my job when I'm left to my own devices.
Right.
Because what that means is that it's not that I don't trust my instincts. It's that my instincts sometimes are the wrong element for that particular scene at that particular moment, that particular delivery. And so I really love it when someone is there with an extremely sharp knife and cutting away all the fat.
I want to talk about an earlier collaboration between the two of you. That's the film Seven, which goes back, almost 20 years now. This is a ghastly murder mystery in a way. And I wanted to hear a scene near the end of the film. And if anybody's concerned about a spoiler alert from a 1995 film, run from your radio. But I'm going to give away some of the plot here. This is a case of two detectives investigating a series of grisly and creative murders, and each one of them represents one of the seven deadly sins, and the murders are crafted to conform to punish the sinner. There's a glutton who's killed in a certain way. Late in the film, the murderer, played by Kevin Spacey, has surrendered and agreed to take the two detectives, played by Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt, to find the final two bodies. So in this scene, they're in their car on the way to this discovery, and we're hearing Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman talk to the killer, played by Kevin Spacey, who's in the back seat of the police car, handcuffed. And we'll hear Kevin Spacey as the killer speak first.
Nothing wrong with a man taking pleasure in his work. I won't deny my own personal desire to turn each sin against the sinner.
Wait a minute. I thought all you did was kill innocent people.
Innocent? Is that supposed to be funny? An obese man? A disgusting man who could barely stand up? A man who, if you saw him on the street, you'd point him out to your friends so that they could join you in mocking him? A man who, if you saw him while you were eating, you wouldn't be able to finish your meal? And after him, I picked the lawyer, and you both must have secretly been thanking me for that one. This is a man who dedicated his life to making money by lying with every breath that he could muster to keeping murderers and rapists on the streets.
Murderers.
A woman.
Murderers, John, like yourself.
A woman. So ugly on the inside that she couldn't bear to go on living if she couldn't be beautiful on the outside. A drug dealer, a drug dealing pederast, actually. And let's not forget the disease-spreading whore. Only in a world this could you even try to say these were innocent people and keep a straight face. But that's the point. We see a deadly sin on every street corner, in every home, and we tolerate it. We tolerate it because it's common. It's trivial. We tolerate it morning, noon, and night. Well, not anymore.
And that's our guest Kevin Spacey in the film Seven, directed by our other guest David Fincher. You know, we after hearing that interesting conversation between the two of you about the collaboration between a director and an actor, I wonder if you could both just talk a little bit about working together and getting this performance.
Well, this is the the scene that you just played the snippet from was probably one of the worst possible scenarios for directors and actors, because it involved a car in the sun with all of these lights hanging off it and trying to find a road long enough that you could have a scene that is this elaborate. And, you know, I mean,
and then you add all the
handcuffs.
Sounds. Yeah, I'm handcuffed in the back of the seat. You have every sound that the car makes and all of the attending equipment around the car that's on the car.
People,
so you know,
you're going to end up
looping, you know, meaning re-recording your dialogue later, in a studio. All I remember really is that in that scene, David said to me at some point, look, I've done a lot of the work up to this point because, you know, the audience is going to have seen, you know, it's a sort of interesting thing about Seven is that you don't actually see
anything.
Act at all. You see the aftermath. And he said, so they're going to be kind of teed up for this. So if you just don't drool, we might get away with this.
But, I mean, it was truly hellish. I mean, it was Palmdale and in summer. And it was about 140 degrees in this car, and we had as many cameras as we could possibly stick in it, and still.
And Brad and I were very tired because we had stayed up very late the night before working on the scene. We were working really hard on the sort of web, the back and forth in that scene. So we were both kind of exhausted as we shot it. That's what I remember.
Yeah, and it was driving. We would drive like for 5 or 6 miles down this road and then stop and have to turn this entire ridiculous caravan around and go back to the beginning.
And do it again.
Yeah. And we fixed this, though. On House of Cards, all of our driving takes place in this very beautiful air-conditioned green screen room so that actors can get in and out of the cars very simply.
And we can say the dialogue that is actually going to be in the series rather than having to go re-loop all of it.
Well, Kevin Spacey, David Fincher, good luck on the series, and I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Spacey stars in, and David Fincher is executive producer of the series House of Cards, now available on Netflix. Coming up, William H. Macy talks about starring in the Showtime series Shameless, which just began its third season. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, William H. Macy, is a veteran actor of stage, film, and television, who's perhaps best known for his role in Fargo, which earned him an Oscar nomination. Among his other films are Boogie Nights, Magnolia, State and Maine, The Cooler, and most recently, The Sessions. Macy's currently starring in the Showtime series Shameless, an edgy comedy in which he plays an alcoholic father of six children in a working-class Chicago neighborhood. Macy's character, Frank Gallagher, is so dissolute that he disappears for long periods of time. In this scene from the third season of Shameless, Frank has woken up from a bender in Juarez, Mexico, and has no idea how he got there. Here he tries to talk his way across the border to the U.S. without ID.
Morning.
Passport?
No. Must have left them in my other pants. But I'm an American citizen, Chi-town, born and raised.
No passport, no entry.
What? Since when?
Since Al-Qaeda decided Americans needed killing.
You see, here's the thing, Agent Tacker. You look like a man who occasionally enjoys a malt beverage, so you can understand. Every once in a while, a couple of drinks can get out of hand. But when it happens next morning, you have to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and get right back on the horse. Am I right? Or am I right? Just let me cross a line. I won't tell anyone. I promise.
You got a driver's license? Any form of photo ID? Costco card.
Do I look like I've got a Costco card?
You look like you need a course of penicillin and a lice comb. Call home. Get somebody to send you some kind of photo ID so we can use it to make you a temporary passport. Get cleaned up. Not letting you into this country so you can add to Texas's homeless population. Next.
William H. Macy, welcome back to Fresh Air. Good to have you.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
What a rich role Frank Gallagher is. You want to describe Frank?
He's an alcoholic, drug-addicted narcissist who happens to have a wickedly good sense of humor, who's pretty smart, very ambitious, hardworking, personable, pretty well-read, surprisingly literate, and a hell of a fun guy to be around. It's a great role. It's hard to make a mistake in this role. You can be outrageous. I can let myself go in a way that I've rarely done in my career. That said, I also find it quite challenging. Sometimes some of the stuff that I'm given to perform is so despicable, and I feel that it's important that the audience always feel that Frank is redeemable somehow, someday. Otherwise, my behavior will be completely boorish, and I think they would kill me off on this show. I'd be unwatchable.
Physically, you know, we just heard this border guard tell him that he looks like he needs a shot of penicillin and a lice comb. You want to talk a little bit about creating the physical side of Frank as an actor?
I've said this a lot, but the whole notion of playing drunk, to my mind, is a bit more of a parlor trick and less acting art. I just happen to be pretty good at doing a drunk. It's more important that I concentrate on the scenes because, you know, it's very easy to just want to turn into the clown. And being a drunk, it's very easy to show off. But the physicality of it, the slurred speech, the way you stare at something, the way you focus and unfocus your eyes, I find that if I sort of plant in my head that he's really loaded, but then superimpose upon that something urgent. In other words, I guess what I'm saying is that Frank takes everything to the max. So he argues vociferously for his point of view. And if you put all that drunkenness under there, it sometimes comes up pretty funny. As far as the look goes, with my long, long hair, and man, it did get long at a point. You can't believe James, the guy that does my hair, James Dunham, tonnage of stuff he puts in my hair to make it look like that. I'm much too good looking for this role is what I'm trying to tell you.
Well, as the show progresses, of course, we find new depths to which your character, Frank, will stoop to manipulate people and scam his next bar bill. And I thought we'd hear a scene. This is from, I believe, the third episode of the current season, where your character Frank has learned of a charity that will do great things for kids with terminal illnesses. Like they gave one kid a basketball with expensive autographs. And so he figures he's going to cash in by using his youngest son, Carl, and give him a terminal illness or make it seem that way. And so we're going to see the son in which you're setting Carl up to play the role here. Carl is played by young actor Ethan Kutkoski. And we'll just say that in the middle of the scene, this will help as people hear it, you start to shave his head, and then one of your older sons briefly interrupts and asks what's going on. So this scene begins with when you've just told Carl he has cancer.
Cancer? How did I get cancer?
You must have caught it from Grammy, son. If she had known that she had the contagious kind, I don't think she would have spent so much time with you in the basement cooking meth.
Am I going to die?
I hope not. But right now, we have to fight. And fight hard. You ready to fight with me, Carl?
Why do we have to shave it?
Didn't you ever see any shows about cancer? Cancer people are always bald.
Grammy wasn't bald.
Grammy hated life. She wanted to die. But you love life. And one of the most important ways you can fight the cancer is to let the sun rays in through your skull.
Why are you shaving Carl's head?
Lice.
Since when do you parent?
Since you dropped the ball, the vermin were literally jumping off his scalp.
I'll make sure you wash the sheets too, okay?
I look like a woman.
I have lice too.
Yes. Yes, you do.
Fiona's gonna freak out.
No, Fiona is not going to freak out because Fiona is not going to know. You're a man now, Carl. The cancer makes you a man. And as a man, it's your job to keep secrets from the women who love you.
And that's our guest, William H. Macy, with the young Ethan Kutkoski in the current season of Shameless, which is on Showtime. A lot of Frank in there. He's pretty quick on his feet there.
He's pretty quick.
When you were a young actor, you collaborated a lot with David Mamet. And I know that when you were on the show before, you talked about that. You did a lot of theater and you worked with him both as a student and as an actor and as a writer. Is it true that when you were in New York, that you were sometimes criticized at auditions when you were trying to get started for having diction that was too good?
Yes. Yes, it happened a lot of times. I still don't understand it, but I think it was I learned my aesthetic from Dave Mamet, and one of the things that drives him crazy, and by extension me crazy, is to go to the theater, or for that matter, go to the movies, and not be able to understand what the damn actor is saying. It puts me in a rage. And, you know, you got a microphone shoved up your nostril. Can't you enunciate enough for me to understand?
We can understand what a drunk Frank Gallagher is saying because you pronounce the words clearly.
Well, I do. I do. And sort of a follow-up to that, your diction is too clear. There's something about this character. It's something about the speed with which we shoot it. I'm doing my best to be less and less respectful, if you will, of the process.
How?
In our theater company, with Felicity, with my wife, we talk about actors. Sometimes some actors, they're good actors, quote-unquote good actors. And then you get these other actors who are completely not, quote-unquote, good, meaning they're not team players. They're just all over the place. They're hard to get to the set. They're unpredictable. They never do the same thing twice. You don't know what they're going to do. They a lot of times turn out to be give the best performance. They're great. And I fall under the category of the good actor. And I'm trying to do less of that and be outrageous. I mean, the most obvious example of it is continuity. The good actor makes sure that if I lift the cup to my lips on this line, I'll do it in every single take. And that takes attention. That takes a lot of energy to remember what you did. And I was always very good at that. And these days, my attitude is more, well, you'll figure it out. I forgot it. Yeah, sue me. And also, they don't worry about it. The way we cut this thing, they do such unorthodox cutting. It's thrilling. Who cares if the cup is a little out of continuity? If it takes you out of the movie, then it's a bad thing. But if you don't care, we'll let it go.
Well, I have to talk about Fargo. I hope you don't mind, even though it's a few years back.
Oh, geez.
Thanks a bunch. You auditioned once, and then the story is that you didn't hear anything, and you went back and made a very strong case. Is that true?
Close. I auditioned for a smaller role, and they said, that's real good. You want to read Jerry? And I said, yes. And so I went out of the room, spent 20 minutes, came back in, read Jerry. And they said, that's real good. You want to work on it and come back tomorrow? I said, yes. Every actor I knew in L.A., they took stages. I was up all night. I memorized the whole script. I wanted this role. So I went back in. They said, that's real good. That's real good. We'll be in touch. And then I heard through my agent that they were in New York auditioning. So I jolly got my ass on an airplane and flew to New York and crashed the audition. And I was making a joke, and luckily it landed, but I said, I'm afraid you're going to screw up your movie and cast someone else in this role. And they went, ha, ha, ha. And I said, no, seriously, I'll shoot your dog if you don't give me this role. And I think Ethan had just gotten a dog.
And they took it the right way.
They took it the right way. That was a good day when I got that job.
And it did great things for your career, I assume. You got an Oscar nomination and, I assume, a lot more offers.
I don't know what I was thinking. I should have gotten one of those Oscar nominations earlier in my career. It does wonders. You're at the grown-ups table. One big film like that, and the best thing that happens is that you don't have to audition anymore, which is, outside of my wife and children, the best thing that's ever happened to me.
This is one of those films, and there are some scenes of yours that I don't care how many times I run across them when I'm channel surfing, I will stop to watch them again. And I thought we'd play one of them here. It's one that I always remember. You're Jerry Lundegaard, kind of at the center of the movie. He's a guy who wants to get rich and hatches a crazy plot that involves criminals kidnapping his wife. In the scene we're going to hear here, you are the sales manager of a car dealership, and a sheriff from another town, who's played by Frances McDormand, has come by. She's investigating one of these crimes related to this plot and believes that the car that the criminals used may have come from this dealership. And it's fair to say that your character, Jerry Lundegaard, has some things to hide. Let's listen.
Mr. Lundegaard, sorry to bother you again. Can I come in?
Yeah, no, I'm kind of busy here.
I understand. I'll keep it real short then. I'm on my way out of town, but I was wondering. Do you mind if I sit down? Carrying a bit of a load here.
No.
It's this vehicle I asked you about yesterday. I was just wondering.
Yeah, like I told you, we haven't had any vehicles go missing.
Okay. Are you sure? Because, I mean, how do you know? Because, see, the crime I'm investigating, the perpetrators were driving a car with dealer plates, and they called someone who works here, so it'd be quite a coincidence if they weren't, you know, connected.
Yeah, I see.
So, how do you... Have you done any kind of inventory recently?
The car's not from our lot, ma'am.
But how do you know that for sure without doing a...
Well, I would know. I'm the executive sales manager.
Yeah, but I understand.
We run a pretty tight ship here.
I know, but... Well, how do they establish that, sir? I mean, are the cars counted daily, or what kind of a routine here?
Ma'am, I answered your question.
I'm sorry, sir?
Ma'am, I answered your question. I answered the darn... I'm cooperating here, and there's no...
Sir, you have no call to get snippy with me. I'm just doing my job here.
I'm not arguing here. I'm cooperating, and we're doing all we can.
And that's our guest, William H. Macy, with Frances McDormand in the Coen Brothers film Fargo.
Ethan Coen, man, that guy can write. Well, they can both write. I don't know who wrote that. I thought Ethan did. I don't know. Joel, I'm sorry if you wrote that.
Right. Well, it's a well-written scene, but I just, you know, it's a guy in a suit behind a desk, and I think you just bring those lines to life. I mean, his panic, you can just feel it.
I totally got what he was doing. He's trying to protect his family. I liked his M.O. I liked the way he tried to protect his family, the way he tried to maneuver this to come up with a good solution always. And it's funny. It was so funny. We did a great take. It kind of made it in, but it didn't. But when I go to meet Peter Stromar and the two bad guys who were going to do the kidnapping, Steve Buscemi and Steve are sitting in the thing, and I walked in, and I sort of imitated a Western. I walked in the door as if I had a gun in my coat pocket or even a holster. I mean, I walked that way. I walked like I was heavily armed and someone was about to die. And then, of course, it's Jerry Lundegaard, and the dialogue is, they say, you're late. And I go, no, I'm sorry. But it was such, I love putting those two things together. Ethan just fell on the floor laughing.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say he's a guy who wants to protect his family because, you know, it seems that he, you know, he's got a comfortable life. His wife's father is rich, so, you know, they don't have to worry about money. Why does he hatch this crazy plot then to have a big ransom and make money? It's so risky. It's you know, crossing to the other side, going against the law.
It is. You know, everybody's the hero of his or her own story, and we do things for the best of intentions. And I think Jerry Lundegaard's point of view was an overpowering despot who was going to try to cull me out of my family's herd, as it was, take care of the kids and the wife and cut me out of it and make decisions that I, as the father, should make. He's a despot. He's a bully.
That's the father-in-law, right? Yeah,
the father-in-law. He's an awful, awful guy. And when you deal with people like that, and I'm sure Jerry Lundegaard was pretty sure that his father-in-law had broken the law himself. He's pretty loose with the facts. And so when you're dealing with people like that, you got to fight them with their own weapons. He set the rules, so don't cry about it. This is Jerry's point of view. So did I step outside the law? Well, technically, but no one was supposed to get hurt. These two fellas that he hired as kidnappers, they're good guys. They're just trying to make a living, and perhaps this will be enough money that they can go straight. And the wife won't get hurt. And the only thing that will happen is that money, as it should, will go from my father-in-law's bank account to my bank account, where it belongs anyway, in a normal world. I'm just trying to set the world straight. You know, that's what I do for a living. I take these outrageous situations, and I've recast the bad guy and the good guy.
Well, William H. Macy, it's been fun. I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's always a pleasure to be here. I love the show. Thank you so much. It's an honor.
William H. Macy stars in the Showtime series Shameless, which is now in its third season and has been renewed for a fourth. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.